in Shakespeare times, classical farce. It offended a great many people, but some people loved it for its farceness. And I wrote it because I needed some farce after writing The Chronology of Water so I didn't just drown, you know, in grief.
Lydia Yuknovich, you're working on a novel now.
Yeah. You want to help me finish it?
You're past fragments, but you're not putting them together, or what?
I'm past fragments. It's polyphonic, meaning for those who aren't as nerdy and obsessed as I am, it has many voices rather than a single hero voice. I have a lot of the fragments. I'd say I'm still working on what the hell to do with them. So come on over. Give me a hand.
You've been listening to an interview with Lydia Yuknovich, whose latest collection of short stories is Verge. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. An extended version of this interview can be found as a Radio Walensky podcast in the Area 941 section of the kpfa.org website. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM and translator K282BH in Philomath at 104.3 FM. And we're streaming at the top of our lungs.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, Oregon, 104.3 FM in Corvallis, and 91.9 FM in Hood River. This is Art Focus, and I am Aurora Josephson, presenting the fifth in a series of studio visits with artists during the pandemic. My guest today is Martha Bergman. In addition to exhibiting her work through the years at Quarter Saw, Mark Woolley, and PDX Galleries, Martha Bergman authored The Gamblin' Color Book about the history of pigments used by oil painters. She also wrote and produced Navigating Color Space, the first three-dimensional video color chart. From 1987 to 2006, Martha was the founder and CEO of Gamblin Artists Colors. Currently, through her website, artconstructionmanagement.com, she advises artists on the materials used to make art. Hello, I am live with Martha Bergman at the Color Factory for the fifth in my Pandemic Studio Visits series. I'm so honored to be here again. I love this place. Thank you for having
Welcome.
Me. Thank you. We started warming up for you already, so we're ready to go. And start by examining the work that you've, you know, we're going to talk a little bit. First we're going to talk about how, if at all, the pandemic has changed your working process. And just given the last year, how would you say your work style has changed? And is it for the better or?
Different.
It's different.
It's okay. Different. And I think that's fantastic. We all need change. But previously, pre-pandemic lifestyle was New York three times a year, once at least to Europe and another country. And this was the longest time I've
traveling.
Been in Portland since the 80s.
Wow.
And I have literally walked between my apartment and my studio virtually every day, all the weather, all the neighbors. And so I am enjoying being in Portland.
So you have a routine that you now change that's every day walking to your studio.
There is nothing else to do.
Yes. And instead of taking these five trips, these whirlwind trips, you know, going to New York and, you know, visiting people in their studios or doing whatever your research you're doing at the time, you have instead dedicated yourself to every day coming and working in the studio.
Yes, painting, mostly painting and writing. And I write for my webpage, Art Construction Management, and because I believe art constructs reality.
Okay. Art constructs reality.
And so my company's named Art Construction Management.
Okay.
And also painters think it's hysterical. Which is why, you know, I chose the name based on
you're trying to charm the painters.
Well, I was a focus group of art students, and I said, what would make you more interested? And so it was kind of done by a committee. But I think the idea of being very rooted in one place and able to do the same work every day, it's the discipline of using color and using it expressively, which is my preference. And also to realize that, you know, painters have, the work of being a painter has changed so much over 600 years of oil painting history, certainly. And the role of painting in the life has changed so much over so many years. But we are living in an era that has a lot of similarities with the Italian Renaissance of the 14th century. Because it also came directly after the catastrophic plagues of the 14th century.
So it's New Enlightenment, perhaps.
New Enlightenment. Well, this, you know, the Renaissance was an awakening.
More than awakening.
You know, to me it was more of an awakening, because due to all, more than just the plague, but what happened with the plague is that, near as I can figure, whole families died. 70% of the population of southern Italy died, and half the population of Florence. And so, you know, all that money was just in the banks. And literally that money was spent decorating Florence.
Amazing.
Making Florence beautiful, and Neoplatonic ideas, and the revival of Greek culture. And but we misunderstand one of the roles of the painter in the Renaissance. The painter was not the one who decided the content of the painting. In other words, a painter was hired to paint the Madonna and Child with Saint Elizabeth, Saint Anne, Simon, and it'll be my brother-in-law Simon, and this, and so it was absolutely, and painting was considered a mechanical art. And so
they were all commissions then.
They were all commissioned. Everything was commissioned. And you would have, a painter would have a studio and have apprentices and people to do the gold leaf and people to do the, if you were going to do some design on stained glass or if you were going to make books or whatever you were going to do, you would have people working for you that did those jobs. But the patrons were the ones responsible for the content.
Interesting.
And now today, most people expect the painter to think it all up, think up the content, think up what it means, think up what it's about, and then paint it, and then wait for somebody to buy it, which is just the opposite of the way it was in the Renaissance.
But maybe you're onto something. If you're looking at it, if you flip it over on its head and look at things like we did in the Renaissance the first time, you might come to a new way of making art.
Oh, definitely, because that's what they did.
That is more demand driven, or by the, you know, what the people, you're, so you're tapping into what we were just talking about, the collective unconscious.
Yes,
what is in the ether at this time. Yeah, that's the word I was looking for.
The fifth element.
And so, like, whether or not it's like this year turquoise is so popular or whatever it is,
right,
you can actually, it's an interesting idea to flip it around a little bit. And
yes.
I see you kind of doing that, like exploring the idea of a study of color.
Right. And that'll lead us into the conversation,
yes,
about color science. And so what my emphasis has been, certainly for the last decade, has been on reimagining and redescribing color science for visual artists. Because after many lectures and many students, hearing students talk, their art education in color science was 200 years old. They were still asking questions that were being asked 200 years ago before microscopes were invented,
and when
before
it was still,
telescopes.
And when it was still called color theory,
and
not
when it was,
color science.
Well, no, there was never, color science was what it was called from the time of Newton until about, I'd say the 20th century.
So
it was all
science.
So the
theory is something totally else. The color theory is a totally different thing than color science.
Yes. Color theory is the artistic choice from the 6 million colors the human eye can see, and about 200 of them that are available is pigments that you can turn into artifacts. Of that, an artist may select a dozen. And they may work with those colors for their entire career, or they may work with a group of six of them and then change out six over time. But that is their theory. That is a color palette that brings their color theory, the artist's color theory, into the material world.
Oh, very interesting.
That's personal.
And it's very similar to the idea in music of a gamut. So that you have your palette of sounds,
right,
that are your particular go-to for a specific work.
Right.
Very,
and you know how to hit those time after time,
right,
after time.
And because that's all it is. That's
right.
All you're using. You're using like the bell and the, you know.
Yes.
So interesting translation for
me. It is.
Sorry.
But I think it is. And I think it is part of the artistic journey. But also, if you're going to make a living making visual arts, you have to know about the hard science, the objects. What is this made out of? What are these colors made out of? The history of colors. Why does this painting look like this?
Okay.
And I can look at a painting and I can tell you pretty much when it was made by based on the colors that were used, because
wow,
those were the pigments that were available.
Wow.
And so as you go through 100,000 years of paint making history, the archaeologists have found a paint making operation in South Africa, in the Valley of Man, that had all three. You have to mix it, you have to mix the pigments together, you have to grind them together with a mortar and pestle, and then they added binder and they made paint for skin and they made paint for stone.
How could you
and
tell
so,
the difference?
But you have to have different binders for skin than you do for stone.
Gotcha.
Because you don't want the binder would rot your skin, would really damage your skin.
Okay.
And so all of these things, but these were known, that we were coloring, human beings were coloring surfaces 100,000 years ago.
100,000 years ago. They were coloring their own skins and...
Their own, and the landscape,
other,
some
the,
part of
wow.
the landscape, either rocks or caves. But all of those things have very specific scientific reasons. Why did they choose limestone caves? Because calcium is toxic, and critters didn't live in those caves, so there wasn't any methane, there wasn't any ammonia from waste.
Wow.
So there was nothing to discolor the walls. And so they didn't necessarily know that, like you and I knowing that calcium's toxic, but they did understand that they needed to put these things in places that wouldn't degrade.
Wow.
So, you know, the idea of human beings, or artists in particular, being different today than we were 100,000 years ago, maybe not so much. And what would you want color for? Well, you would want color for, one of the number one reasons why linseed oil is the binder and has been for 10,000 years, is that if you make a varnish paint out of linseed oil and color and pigment, you can make your boat float. It makes things waterproof.
Oh, wow.
So all fishing cultures use linseed oil. And because they need it. But then now, so everybody's got their boat, the wood coated, they've got their boats made, and they're ready to go. How do you tell the difference between your boat and mine?
Oh, then that's where the decoration comes.
I think so.
Yes.
I want yellow. You want red.
Yes.
And so, and the color theory and the color science was identical, because there are very few pigments that you can dig up out of the ground that will make a colored paint.
Okay.
Because everything that makes a colored paint is a crystal.
Oh, wow.
It's a transition metal. It's a crystal.
I didn't know that.
And so...
why art is magic. Okay.
Well, I think so. And it's also interesting to note that calcium is a key component of the earth, 5% of the earth. It's also 5% of the human body, our bones. And so art, traditional oil painting, traditional murals, almost everything... certainly at the Renaissance, was made from exactly the same chemical composition as the human body.
Wow. Wow. So it's almost like an instinct, or that we...
We're connected.
It's all connected.
We're connected. Yeah. But anyway, that is why I think color science is useful, because it's entertaining. And it's also connecting.
Well, it's the color science, I definitely wanted to talk to you about that because I know you have a lot of history with colors.
In your
work and as you're consulting with other artists as well.
Well, what I've come up with is I've come up with the absolute minimum that I think every visual artist needs to know, and I call it Martha's six common notions on color after Euclid, so that we can get it right.
Oh, beautiful.
So, a hue is a bandwidth of frequencies in the electromagnetic spectrum. A color is a single frequency. Colors can be transmitted, reflected, and emitted. There are no primary colors. There are only primary hues. The primary hues in the human visual spectrum are from shortwave to long, violet, blue, green, yellow, orange, and red. Six primary hues can be arranged into three complementary pairs: violet, yellow, blue, orange, and green, red. Colors in complementary pairs can create simultaneous contrast. That's the way to make colors brighter.
Wow.
Then that's everybody wants to know how to make the colors brighter. I call it the human quest for brighter colors.
The human quest for brighter colors. That's beautiful, Martha. Thank you.
So I felt that's the minimum. If people know that, then they can arrange their colors accordingly.
Okay. Well, let's backtrack one little bit and just talk a little bit about when you come to your studio every day, what series of art have you been working on? You've been exploring color, I can see, with some of these paintings over here. And you've been exploring with mediums, I think you mentioned?
Mostly color, because my interest for the last few years has been in the Renaissance painting techniques.
Okay.
Because I have noticed that the four basic, there's about Botticelli, Leonardo, Raphael, and Michelangelo, those painters, and at the time, because they were mechanical artists, even though Raphael was an architect, they used their techniques as a marketing strategy. The Madonna and Child from Raphael looked different from the Madonna and Child of Botticelli. And if you wanted to have that I would say Raphael might have been better with the Greeks. And Leonardo really preferred to have his subjects emerge from the darkness while the other ones wanted the dark. So if you wanted a strong line with a bright color, you might go with Raphael. You wanted a pale line, a strong line with pale colors, you might want to go with Botticelli. If you wanted to have the lightness coming out of the darkness, you might have gone with Leonardo. And for Michelangelo, he was the great illustrator, because Michelangelo was the only one who knew all the rules and threw them out.
Wow.
And so they all made this up. Oil painting did not exist. It did not exist. They made this up. The first oil painting was made in 1415 by Brunelleschi, and it was a painting with perspective.
Okay.
And that's the first perspective painting, one of the earliest all oil paintings. And the reason that they chose oil painting, linseed oil based oil painting, because they wanted transparency.
Interesting.
And none of the materials that they had to date were transparent. All were opaque.
Oh.
So you could, murals are opaque, any kind of stonework. So painting on murals, one of my other ones, tempera, of course, is an opaque media. And there's one other one that I'm not going to bother trying to find. But the point being that they wanted perspective. And in order to make perspective, they had to create depth inside the picture frame. So that's what I've been exploring, is how to create depth inside the picture frame using color and not black and white.
Wow. So no black and white, all color.
Well, and I do use the white because I have to make them tints, because the difference between the colors that we have today and painters had what was available 600 years ago is they didn't have much.
Are you limiting yourself to the palette as well?
No. Well, I was for a year,
for a while.
But now I'm not. But the point being is, what I realized is that paint was precious.
Right.
And only really prosperous painters could use a full palette.
Wow.
And these four were among them. So they were all used full chromatic palette. The six primary hues, okay, that's a full chromatic palette. I think the amazing thing about the idea of Michelangelo decided to model space without using perspective because he didn't have enough room. So, you know, if you think of the Sistine Chapel, he couldn't create space because he didn't have enough space to get it back there. So he had to invent what they're called cangianti, which is a technique of using color to create three-dimensional images. And I would say Emily Mason, I think I mentioned her earlier, she was probably the heir of Michelangelo because her paintings were almost always cangianti. And in fact, she was my go-to on Michelangelo's paintings.
Wow. So cangianti.
So people are still using the techniques.
Okay.
We just don't necessarily have the same names.
It's sort of evolving.
Right.
But it's still in that collective kind of ether.
But almost no, very, very few, almost no artists use perspective today.
Oh, interesting.
That's evolved out.
I want to actually also talk about a particular image, maybe the one that really struck me on the end.
The temptation, especially as an expressionist, is to leave it alone.
Okay.
To leave it alone. And so because I paint for my own amusement, I almost never leave it alone. But that one I left alone because what I was trying to do is I made a toned ground out of a steel blue gray, probably at a light value 4, light value. And then I happened to have on my palette 3 of the quinacridones. I had quinacridone magenta, I had red, and I had violet. And so I just thought, well, okay. And so I just loaded up a brush and I made that mark. And then I went back into the wet paint with white, and that's that.
Wow.
And so I won't be like that.
I'm going to take a picture of this one to be posted on the website. But because it's so amazing, this effect is like a transparent gauze over.
And you know, there's a painter, Joseph Cotton. No, it's not his name. That's a movie star. What's his name? Tom Cotton, I think. Anyway, he uses that pink, but he does like cowboys in pink. I mean, you know, he's sort of very, very postmodern.
Fun.
But I think mostly keeping the canvases inside a limited color range.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of doing a whole series in a limited color range in a color theory, for this series, I'm looking at each surface as completely its own thing.
Mm.
And so it doesn't ever have to match. It never has to go together. Because, you know, when you prepare work for exhibition, it does have to hang.
Right.
It does have to hang together.
But you're doing this for yourself, so you don't
Completely.
Have to. You can have each piece be its own world separately.
And it's very freeing.
Oh, I bet it is. Well, it seems like it is.
So that's the pandemic year.
The pandemic year is a vast exploration of color.
Yeah. Yeah, and especially for me, since I've always painted, but mostly I've been a teacher.
Okay.
This last decade.
Now you're a real painter because you're doing it every
day. Now I've got forced into taking my own lessons.
Yes, you're actually you're subjecting yourself to your own lessons.
And that's what it feels like.
You're taking yourself to task.
Right, and also one of my a painter friend of mine in New York, Martha Keller, also a professor of art at Hunter. She loaned me her students through the steep development of my 6 common notions on color. I had a very steep development climb into those ideas, and she let me try them all out on her students. And so we still will have that conversation, the big broad conversation, but it's not the same as having that big broad conversation at the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Okay, so and how did the students take it? Did you enjoy the process of?
Oh yes, I enjoyed them very much. And the wonderful thing about the class that I practiced on, it was required.
Oh great.
So I didn't lose anybody.
They had to stay with you, or they wouldn't go anywhere.
But we had worked out some interesting exercises because she also comes from a painting family and brought sharpened the distinction between color theory and color science for me, really kept sharpening that, as did another friend, Zora Pinney in Los Angeles, kept sharpening that, because one of the things about color theory is, you know, that's what painting teachers teach, is their own color theory. And I didn't want in any way to, that is what they teach, but it is what I want to offer is complementary.
Mm.
And it's not science or theory. It is, until about 150 years ago, everybody learned what we're discussing. Everybody learned the science, what colors would react, how to set up, make varnishes, how to, you know, and now literally you just have to open a cap, squeeze the paint on, and paint. But painting has also changed. Painting is no longer in and of itself a premier media. It is now, most oftentimes as I'm seeing it, part of where mixed media used to be using oil and water paint on the same canvas. Now mixed media means that you're going to have painting, digital, music,
and
human voice,
yep,
and they're going to share a communal space.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's how we define mixed media today.
And that's like a happening.
It is. And so painting again is devolving into one of a mixed media.
Wow.
And it's just evolution. I mean, art changes, life changes.
Right.
People want different things. And this is, and it's also very, you don't see as much oil painting as you see acrylics. And so, and that to me is, I'm going to do a little pitch here. I want you to know how disconcerting it is to take a ride through the backcountry in New Mexico and see whole hillsides stained with phthalo blue and phthalo green, because people were washing their pigments down into their septic systems and now they're staining the landscape. You cannot wash acrylic paints down the drain.
Please do not wash acrylic paints down
Please
the drain.
Please do not do this. It is, after you put the paint in the water, it's garbage. So let the water evaporate, take all of the sludge, just like, you, and throw it in the garbage.
Okay.
And send it to the garbage, where
yeah.
it belongs. And so, because it is to me, the one change where the science was lost.
Okay.
Because people, that science is lost, that you can just go ahead and dump stuff down the drain. That's
okay.
science, a failure of science, and a failure of art education.
Interesting.
So yeah, I think but it's interesting to be in an industry for so long that you can see it go up and down.
Yeah, I bet
yeah.
you've seen quite
yeah.
a bit in
yeah.
the transformation of the artist industry over how many years have you?
Well, it'd probably be close to 40.
Wow.
Yeah.
Congratulations. It's
yes.
a nice long career.
Yeah, well, it's a long career. And it's also a wonderful retirement career.
Well, you're never going to be bored.
Never. Never.
It always changes.
Always beautiful.
Always beautiful.
Even when the colors look, it always beautiful.
What are you working on now? So you've got these little color environments that are their own, each one is their own little world.
Right.
Okay. And so they're studies. They're
right.
A series of studies that you've been doing for the last year
right.
or so. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to take it on the road.
Okay.
I'm going to teach a workshop down at the beach.
Ooh.
And on Renaissance painting techniques.
Ooh.
And it is a wonderful conversation to share with people who are interested. And the history and the evolution of the ideas and the evolution of ideas through painting. And I feel that what I hope to do is have it be more of a cultural immersion, where we're not just going to look at these things as isolated, but as marketing strategies, as a way to get people's attention, as a way to lead the eye around the canvas, because mm-hmm. the content of those was prescribed. So if you wanted it to be about, your patron wanted it to be about something, well, you had to make sure that your customer looked at that first.
Interesting.
You know?
Okay, so then, and then the eye would be drawn around a canvas a certain way.
By the color.
By the color.
So we'll use Raphael because everybody can imagine, I think most people can, he's so prominent, but you would look up at one of his murals and you would look for that simultaneous contrast. Where was that yellow-violet intersection? Where was that? Because it's the brightest part of the painting.
Oh.
And it's always the human quest for brighter colors. So if you want to know what the painting is about, look where the artist is putting your eye. And if the artist isn't putting your eye anywhere, move along.
Well, with that, thank you so much for
thank you.
Having me here. This has been a delight. It's a delightful space. I will post some of the paintings on my website and as well as the KPU website for your viewing pleasure. And thank you so much.
Thank you, and again, welcome. It's been a pleasure.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, 104.3 FM in Corvallis, and 91.9 FM in Hood River. This is Art Focus, and you have been listening to the fifth in a series of pandemic studio visits. My guest today was Martha Bergman. I am Aurora Josephson, and I wish to thank Ava Lake, Joseph Gallivan, Ray Bodwell, and the other staff at KBOO, which helped make this segment a reality. Thank you. We also ask you art lovers out there to consider subscribing to KBOO on our website, kboo.com. We hope you enjoyed the program. Take care.
Que vamos a delirar, deliremos por un ratito.